Welcome to In-Depth, an in-depth look at the interesting, educational, and timely topics affecting you right here in South Central Iowa and beyond. The one to count on for today's local news coverage is KNIA and KRLS. Now with today's In-Depth, here's Dr. Bob Leonard.
The past isn't always pretty. Let's go in depth with Erica Spiller, author of Iowa's Women's Corrections, A History. Erica, where are you from?
I am from Urbandale, Iowa.
And you went to school at Urbandale High, I presume?
Yes, I did.
And then you went to Simpson College, I understand.
I did. I finished my bachelor's degree there, and I actually started prior to Simpson with an associate's degree at Des Moines Area Community College.
Okay, and what did you study at Simpson?
I studied theater and English while I was at Simpson.
And you've continued your work in theater?
I have, yes. I've been volunteering with Tallgrass Theater Company for, I think it's about nearly 15 years at this point. I've directed, I've done some playwriting, and currently I work as one of their resident lighting designers.
You have a new book out, just out, and it's about Mitchellville, the Women's Correctional Facility. How did you get from theater to writing a book about women's corrections?
That's a great question. Well, you know, I've always had a bit of an interest in corrections, and, you know, I started in theater and ended up double majoring in English as well. So when I got my first teaching job, I ended up connecting with another colleague of mine who was the criminal justice chair. And so her name's Peggy Long. She's a contributor on the book. And she and I just worked a lot with our criminal justice students and went on a lot of tours. And we had some adjunct faculty who worked at ICIW as well. So just over time, I, you know, spent quite a bit of time with those folks. And when we were talking about the new facility that they were working on at the Mitchellville site, we had asked if there was going to be any sort of preservation or anything of the original site with all the history that it has. And we were told, no, that's all going to be sort of leveled. So then Peg and I thought, well, we don't want that to happen. We need to, you know, preserve this history somehow. So we started off just wanting to sort of research the history of the site. And then we realized there wasn't really a comprehensive history that we could find anywhere of women's corrections and sort of their path to prisons from really the beginning, even before they were at Mitchellville. So the English major with the interest in history sort of took over, and then Peg, of course, lended her knowledge and experience from being a criminal justice chair, and she used to work at ICIW. So that just sort of brought us together. We worked on the research process for about the first 5 years or so, and then I took over into the writing phase.
And so when was it built?
So the newest facility, the one that reopened about 2012, I think, is when they really started moving the women down there. So that's the newer one. Prior to that, they were in, it's hard to even call it the original facility because it really wasn't, they were in some of the buildings that had been used for the girls' reform school. And those had been built in 1930s, 1960s, but on that same site where those original buildings were, there had been even older buildings there. Thomas Mitchell had actually started it as a school. That didn't last very long, and then the state bought it for the girls' reform school in 1880. So that site has actually been in use for incarcerating juvenile females since 1880, and then the women moved there, the adult women, in 1982.
More in depth after this.
I continued my conversation with Erica Spiller, author of Iowa Women's Corrections, A History. Your book isn't just a chronology. I'm sure that there's some social history in it, too.
There is, and that's one of the things that's really interesting is you can see how what's happening in society is really influencing not only what women are being incarcerated for, but how they're being treated while they are held in the various facilities they've been in.
Of course, the prison has to reflect society, but I have a suspicion when you tell me more, we're going to regret and I don't know, feel some pain for earlier generations of women. Am I correct?
You are. So really what we're looking at, and of course, you're always going to have the cases that we would expect, you know, homicides and these types of things. But generally what we see early on in women's incarceration are women being sent to prison for things that are called crimes against public decency. So we actually found cases where, for example, a man and a woman would be caught engaging in relations with each other. The woman would be sent to prison. The man would get nothing. No ticket, no fine, no jail time, nothing. You see a similar trend with juvenile females as well. One of the most common reasons that girls were sent to the reform school was for what was called incorrigibility. Some of that could have been a parent or guardian saying, I just can't handle her. Maybe she did or didn't do anything wrong. But interestingly, in some of those cases, we found that they maybe weren't incorrigible, but their parent was maybe either fearful for their safety for some reason, perhaps there was some abuse going on, and so they would say they were incorrigible to get them to a safer place. So that really happens early on in the history, and then it transitions a little bit later where we start to see more paper crimes, and then of course, when we get into the war on drugs and mandatory minimums in more recent history, then you start to see substance abuse becoming a big cause.
Mm-hmm. So let me make sure I get this right. So that I'm just guessing maybe a mother in a relationship with an abusive man might say her daughter is incorrigible to save her from the family situation?
Yes, we did find some situations of that. We also found some situations where a parent couldn't care for their child. They weren't making enough money. They weren't able to feed them and provide a safe home for them. And so they would say they were incorrigible. And there's a specific case that we talk about in the book about that. And so, you would see a variety of reasons why they would be listed as incorrigible. However, more often than not, it was usually somebody who was a girl who was maybe running away or was maybe getting into relationships before a parent wanted them to, and types of things that we certainly would not incarcerate somebody for today, but it was very common. I think, if I remember correctly, during certain periods, it was somewhere around 70% of the girls that were in the reform school were there for incorrigibility.
Well, and it's incorrigibility as determined in a more patriarchal society, and that maybe maybe these girls were brilliant or just wanting to break the binds of society, and we put them in jail?
You're exactly right. That patriarchal society certainly comes into play in some of the situations we discuss as well. One that's not in the girls' school, but was in when the women were in Anamosa, was actually a murder trial that took place in Indianola. And one of the things they had talked about was that the individual in this case had been a victim of domestic violence, both against her and her children, for an extended period of time. She was brought to trial for, she'd been accused of murdering her husband. And one of the things that was pointed out was that, of course, at this time, there were no women on the jury. It was an all-male jury. And in fact, at the time, Susan Glaspell, who would go on to write the play Trifles and the story A Jury of Her Peers, had been a reporter in Iowa and had reported on this trial, and that trial was part of what inspired her to go on and write those pieces.
More in depth after this.
I continued my conversation with Erica Spiller, author of Iowa Women's Corrections, A History. There are violent men and women, but I'm guessing, given how domestic violence often plays out, a lot of the time these women a lot of it was self-defense.
Yes, and that's something that we encountered as well, where if these situations had occurred today, the charge, you're exactly right, probably would have been something more in line with acting in self-defense. A lot of the murder cases, especially early on, were related to children or mothers, or together, children and mothers who were responding to a violent home situation.
And a jury of all men.
Right.
And that had to bias it. I mean, and during some of those times, male abuse was condoned, sanctioned by society even.
Right, and that's actually something that was mentioned in the trial of this Indianola homicide case that I mentioned, was that on multiple occasions, this woman, her name's Margaret Hosek, she had gone to the neighbors and she had pleaded with them for help. And they had even told her, no, you know, this is not appropriate for you to be discussing this with us. You need to go home to your husband. And so they actually ended up using her reports of abuse as evidence against her to say, well, she must have done this. And her case would later be overturned. And there's actually a wonderful book called Midnight Assassin. Patricia Bryan's one of the authors on that. And it goes deep into the case and, you know, to the point where we think now she probably didn't even do it. It was perhaps one of the children who did it. But you're exactly right. It was something that was expected and something that maybe shouldn't even be talked about according to the standards of that time.
Wow. This is all a tragedy. A great tragedy.
It is. And I think that's one of the interesting pieces about this book. And one of the reasons we felt we needed to do this research and I needed to record it was, I don't think we have the whole story yet. We really talk about a lot of our history and how we are where we are sort of through that male lens. You know, historically, that's who's been writing the stories. That's who the stories have been written about on the whole. And I think this book serves as a good example of when you do the sort of same historical explorations, but you do them through a different lens, looking at a different group, you see really quickly that, of course, there are similarities, but a lot of differences emerge too. And that can also help inform, okay, how do we help women now? If we see the differences in how they're getting into prison and some of these different cultural impacts, then do we need to look differently at how we're supporting them and treating them?
Well, I want to dig in a little bit about that in a moment. But first, can you tell me where we can find your book?
Absolutely. So the book is available online through the publisher, through most major retailers. Also, I would encourage individuals to reach out to their local bookstores, Page Turners, Book Vault. If they don't have it available, of course, they can order that for you. It should be available many places.
Well, very good. All right, now you sort of touched on this, looking at things through a different lens. And I don't know if you want to speculate or not, but as we're sitting here judging history and the treatment of women in the past, we can see that, you know, some of the treatment was horrific. How's the future going to judge what we're doing now?
That's a big question, and you're right. It's hard to speculate, but what I'll tell you is this. It's been nice to see that there has been more attention given to how women are being treated and to what some of their outcomes are. The ACLU has defined women as the group with some of the fastest growing incarceration rate. And in fact, when you look at some recent reductions in male incarceration, you see that the same impacts aren't happening with women. So places like the Prison Policy Initiative, they're talking about this a lot. The ACLU, they're talking about this a lot. So people are focusing on it, even here locally. You'll see in the book that the current warden of the institution and then the prior warden, Patty Wachendorf, they both had made changes to the institution with the intention of treating women in a way that was maybe more in line with what they would need. The part that's concerning, though, is where you're seeing that conversation happening is really with the practitioners. We're not seeing that conversation happening, or at least I'm not really encountering it as much yet on a broader level. And so I hope that, you know, criminal justice reform is a very popular topic, as it should be, and I hope that if we do take on that work in the serious way that it needs to be done, that as that's happening, that we are looking at the different populations and their needs and making plans according to that.
So are you hopeful for the future with respect to incarceration and women?
You know, I think you have to be. And I think that one of the most important pieces that we have now is information. You really see, like I said, you're seeing more attention being brought to it, and not just with women. You're seeing where there's more attention to the fact that we can't take broad brush strokes in reform. So I think we have to be hopeful, because if you're not, you know, the only alternative is sort of giving up, and we can't do that. Our communities need us. These women need us. Our future generations need us to take these issues seriously and keep pushing for them however we can.
Thanks to Erica Spiller for contributing to the program.
For KNIA KRLS News, this is Dr. Bob Leonard bringing you today's news and information in depth from our little corner of the universe.
An audio copy of today's in-depth program is available at KNIAKRLS.com on demand or for download. Just click podcasts. If you have topics or show ideas you'd like to hear in depth, contact KNIAKRLS by sending an email to Bob Leonard at KNIAKRLS.com. The one to count on for today's local news and the number one news and information source in South Central Iowa is KNIAKRLS.